Going to start the book of Exodus, and rather than give a formal outline of the book, I think I'm going to let the first chapter introduce it. The first chapter really forms really a beautiful introduction to the book, and there is a nice spot in there where we can throw in some of the historical background. So will you open your Bibles to the book of Exodus? Genesis is the book of beginnings. It records the beginnings of the universe, the beginning of matter, the beginning of plant life, animal life, the beginning of man, the beginning of sin, the beginning of redemption, and the beginning of Israel. Exodus takes up the narrative, the historical narrative, right where Genesis leaves off. And we're left no doubt about it when we read the first verse. That little word "now" that you see, the first word in Exodus 1, is really a while consecutive, which is simply the Hebrew conjunction "and." And I came across something rather surprising last week. I counted the verses in chapters 1 and 2, and I think I counted something like 38 or 39 times. That couldn't be. That's right. There's 47 verses. I think 38 times the verse begins with "and." Okay? That's not so important with us. It's important in the sense that the writer of the book of Exodus is trying to show you how something is unfolding. And he says, this thing, and then this thing, and then this thing, and this thing. But the important thing for us in the first verse and the first word is that it makes it apparent that whoever wrote Genesis simply takes up with Exodus and connects it with the conjunction "and." And then if you, we don't have time to look now, but if you would look, you'll find that the book of Leviticus and the book of the Numbers begins the same way. They begin with that little conjunction "and." And these are the names of the children of Israel which came into Egypt. Every man and his household came with Jacob. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher. And all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. Now all that does is tie you in to the end of the narrative of the book of Genesis. It is a summary statement. But the next verse says, and the children of Israel were fruitful. This is the key, one of the key verses in the first chapter. And increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceeding mighty. It literally says, and grew mighty exceedingly, exceedingly. Kind of a Hebraism. And the land was filled with them. Okay? Now, you probably know the story of the rest of the chapter. The rest of the chapter talks about a dynasty arising, a Pharaoh arising, who was not identified with Joseph, meaning he didn't have meaningful interaction with Joseph, and he begins a persecution. The oppression on the Israelitish people begins. And you actually have jumped about 200 years between verse 7 and verse 8, without there any indication of it in the text. But despite the oppression that this new Pharaoh brings upon the people, they still keep growing and multiplying and sort of taking over the land. Okay? So what is Exodus 1 really all about? Exodus 1. What is the theme? What is the movement of the passage? The theme of the passage is just God's sovereign production. God's sovereign production. And we are going to find that this book is going to emphasize the sovereignty of God in redemption. God's sovereign production hyphen blessing despite oppression. Okay. The theme of the book will be God's sovereign redemption. Okay, how he acts sovereignly in redemption. It's going to be just a beautiful thing. It's going to be reinforced throughout the book. And one of the ways that chapter 1 reinforces it is that despite all the human efforts to stop the massive production machine called the Nation of Israel, and the human production, the increase in population, the population explosion, despite everything that they did, they couldn't stop it. Okay? Now, the way that Moses is led to develop this theme is something like this, if you're taking notes. The first paragraph, verses 1 through 7, which we read, simply records Israel's increase. Israel's increase from circa, CA means circa, about 1876 to circa 1500 BC. Okay? Okay, we are told first of all in verses 1 through 4 that there were 70 souls upon entree into Egypt. When they came down, these 12 sons with all the people with them totaled 70. Okay? Verse 1 through 4. And the names, of course, of the patriarchs are listed. This happens, we said, circa 1876 B.C., when Jacob came with his family to Egypt. The second thing that that paragraph records, point B, is the death of that patriarchal generation, or we could say the death of Joseph and his brethren. Okay? The whole generation, we're told. Verse 6, and Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. By the way, they're all, the bones of all of these are carried back to Canaan, according to the, not just Joseph's bones, but the bones of all the patriarchs are carried back, according to the speech of Stephen in Acts 7. This carries the narrative, the death of Joseph is circa 1804 B.C., see? So you carry the narrative up to verse 6, at least to 1804. But the key verse, or the verse that is really emphasized in the Hebrew text, is really the population explosion that goes on apparently after this, or maybe even some time after this. The population explosion. This is what I want to dwell on a little bit to try to emphasize what this Hebrew text emphasized, okay? In Hebrew, in order to emphasize something, sometimes you say it three or four times in a row. Only you use a little different emphasis, see? And it reaffirms and over and over again reaffirms the fact, and it's sort of a way of getting it into your cranium. Hebrew poetry is this way. This is not poetry. This is simply a statement of fact. Okay, here is the way the population explosion is emphasized in the Hebrew text. One, this is all verse 7. They were fruitful. They were fruitful. Okay? Now, that simply means productive, and all it is a cal stem. It's simply a statement of fact. It means to bear. This means human production or production in terms of children. Okay? Okay, just a common word for that. But the second word, which the King James translates, increased abundantly, literally means to swarm. Okay, so the second thing that it says, they were fruitful, they increased abundantly, literally they swarmed. And it's like the idea of Miller moths or flies. That means they were hyper-productive. They were hyper-productive. We're just going through a baby boom in Holly Hill. There was a baby boom all the time during these years, apparently. Okay? And the word is in the imperfect form. It means it just kept on. It just kept on going on. See? Okay. Then the King James says, "And they multiplied," which is an excellent translation. They multiplied, because that's exactly what this word means. The only emphasis that we can help you with in it is that it's a PL stem, which is an intensified stem. In other words, if somebody murdered somebody, and you just happened to murder them for, you know, maybe somebody was coming in your house and robbing you and you shot them and you murdered them, you would just use a cal stem and you would state the fact that this person murdered so-and-so. But if somebody brutally murdered somebody, I mean, you sort of planned it out and you were very efficient at this and you ruthlessly killed them, you would use a PL stem. So this is the intensive stem, intensive active stem. Okay? So how would we... I don't know. Everyone got in the act is the way I translated this. Everyone got in the act. It was a very intensified action. Okay? It's the Hebrew word rahbah in the PL imperfect stem. Now, the effect... You can have a large population, but that doesn't mean you're a strong people. But this people was strong in their ties with one another, in their bonds with one another. And so the next statement says, "And they waxed exceeding mightily." Now, I'd like to translate that more literally. This doesn't refer now to the fact that they had more and more children. It's just the fact that the bonds and the unity of these people was really intensive. And they grew strong. I'm going to give it you this just like the Hebrew does. "And they grew strong exceedingly, exceedingly." Now, I realize that that's... when you transliterate that way, that it sounds a little funny, but nevertheless, that's what it says. And so what the King James does is say, "They waxed exceedingly mighty." Okay? Now, this is the idea of intensive unity. Intensive unity and strength among these people. Okay? Okay, the fifth thing it says is the land was filled with them. The land was filled with them. Okay, now all of that is verse 7. And that is the dominating verse of the first section of this paragraph. Okay? Now, this probably means that the Hebrews overflowed Goshen and maybe occupied territories down along the river. How far, we wouldn't know, because when it comes to getting them together, there's communication. There would be a communication problem in that. But nevertheless, the idea is an intensive swarming mass of people. Now, to help us with that... what did verse 3 said? Okay, 70 souls, right? Let's try to get some idea about numbers here. Circa 1876 B.C. equals 70 souls. Now, we don't know what year we're in precisely right here. We know when the new dynasty arises, verse 8. That's around 1580 or 1570 B.C. But we know when they get into the wilderness, they take a census. And when they take the census, it comes out that there are 603,000 fighting men, which means age 20 up. And that is about 1446 B.C. See, 1446 B.C. equals 603,000 fighting men, age 20 up. Okay? And we know that by Numbers chapter 1, where they have the first census, where they are numbered. Okay. Now, how can we compute from this what the population of the Exodus was? Well, being very conservative, you could say that this 603,000 was maybe around between one-third and one-fourth of the population. And that's being very conservative, because the idea here is they were really having a lot of children. So with that continued down toward the time of the Exodus, then it would be much more than that. So conservatively, population at the Exodus, conservatively, would equal between 1,800,000, I'm sorry, I made that a comma. We could say it would equal between 1.5 to 2 million. And you would be making a very, very conservative effort estimate at that. Is that a radical figure? Can 70 souls in the space of 430 years increase from this number to this number? Is that difficult? No. Let me show you something. If you had 100 people, if you had 100 people, 100 persons, now we have to divide that, male and female, of course, at 5% growth rate per year, over 215 years equals 2 million people. In other words, if they simply had a 5% growth rate, what was the growth rate in the United States last year? 1.5%? Population zero has done a lot of field work and has gotten the growth rate in the United States down considerably. But a 5% growth rate is not a large growth rate. Okay? But the idea was that whatever years we are in verse 7, there is an intensified population growth rate, and God is overseeing this thing. He's going to pull these people out, and He wants them to be strong. And so He's seeing to it that it happens. But all they see is the fact that they're in Egypt. And pretty soon, all they're going to see is oppression. Okay? Any questions on verses 1 through 7? You're laying the background in this chapter for the book of Exodus. All right? Let's take the second point. Second point. Now something's going to happen to stop, see, to stop this thing from happening. And human beings are going to become involved in that effort. So in verses 8 through 22, the idea is that Israel's increase continues despite the oppression. Despite the oppression. Okay? Okay. Now we know that Moses is born around 1526 B.C. And this chapter takes us right up to 1526 B.C. We know that the 18th dynasty, which is the new pharaohs that knew not Joseph, start around 1580. So we're somewhere in the years right around 1500, the years just preceding it, in order to get Moses born. See? And we can almost pinpoint this pharaoh who begins the oppression. Okay? So we are talking about the years circa 1500 40 will make a guess forward. Okay? Okay, now I'll have to give you some historical background, because we're introduced to a pharaoh that knew not Joseph in verse 8. Okay, the new dynasty, capital A. The new dynasty. Verse 8. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. That's simply a transitional statement to show you that something happened politically in the land where there was not a pharaoh who was favorable to the Jewish people. When this chapter ends, this pharaoh will make a law saying that all the male Hebrew children that are born have to be killed. The next chapter will begin with the birth of Moses and show how he is miraculously saved. So we're taking a pharaoh that takes us right up to the birth of Moses. But a whole dynasty had to be introduced before that could happen. Okay? Okay, this new dynasty, the key idea was they knew not Joseph. Okay? Okay, now let's get the history to help us with this. We are now going to rough out sort of the history between circa 1800 and, say, 15. Well, let's take it right down to the, maybe to the Exodus, 1446. And we get introduced to some tremendous characters here. Next week, I hope to have a film strip to show you some of the grandeur that surrounded the new kingdom of Egypt. Egypt now comes into its apex of power. It comes into its empire period. And it does that with the 18th dynasty. But before that happens, there are intermediate rulers. Okay? There is an intermediate reign, or intermediate rulers, called the Hyksos kings. And these run roughly from about circa 1780 to 1580 BC. You'll find these dates will differ. The dates that I'm giving you roughly correspond to a man named Breasted, who was sort of a famous Egyptologist at the turn of the century. And for a long time, his dates have stood. In recent writings, I read Chester Starr, for instance, last year, and he has the dates moved up about 10 years from what Breasted did. Charles Ryrie has different dates than what you'll see up here. But nevertheless, we're going to give you approximate dates. Who were the Hyksos? Let's just put down one thing. They were good for Israel. These were some form of Shemitic nomads that came down and conquered the land of Egypt around 1800, or around the turn of that. They began to infiltrate northern Egypt, and then they worked their way down and conquered the whole nation of Egypt. They were either desert princes or shepherd kings. It is known that they comprised the 13th to the 17th dynasties. So you have a break in the continuity of the Egyptian pharaohs themselves. You have foreigners coming in and becoming pharaohs. And these people, most likely because they're fellow Shemites, did not bother the Hebrews. We have no mention of them, however, in Scripture. Okay? Okay. Verse 8 introduces the 18th dynasty. Okay? And the first king in the 18th dynasty was a man named Pharaoh Ames the First. And each character, I don't know why it is in history that everybody has two names, or maybe three names, just to make it all the more confusing. But Pharaoh Ames the First is the initial king in this dynasty. He is able to amass enough power to push the Hyksos out around 1580 or 1570 BC. This most likely was the king who knew not Joseph. Okay? Okay. He reigns from circa 1580 to 1560 BC. And the big event in his reign was he was able to push these Hyksos all the way out from southern Nile all the way up onto its entree into the Mediterranean Sea. Now the point is that if the Hebrews are Shemites and the Hyksos were Shemites, and now the Hebrews are swarming in numbers, it's possible that the Hyksos might want to come back, and then the Hebrews might join in a coalition with them against the Egyptian pharaohs and try an insurrection and a rebellion against the pharaohs themselves, see? And it may be that the Hebrews might take over. So, though the fears of the pharaoh were subjective, nevertheless, they had a potential reality because of the fact of these Hyksos rulers that had reigned for over 200 years. Okay? So circumstances are working out humanly, and yet God sovereignly is getting ready to remove this people. It's a tremendously exciting time in history. And I think it's unique that God does not take them out of Egypt when Egypt is weak. He takes them out of Egypt when Egypt is in the strongest position she had ever been in historically. There's a little verse I'd like to show you in chapter 12. Will you look at it for a minute? Chapter 12, verse 12. This is the verse that where God is speaking relative to the Exodus. I will pass through the land of Egypt this night, and I will smite the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And then notice, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am Jehovah. That is sort of the theme of this book, that Jehovah God is going to clobber the concepts of God that permeate the land of Egypt. And they had at least 80 gods. And God is just going to smite. The Pharaoh himself was viewed as a personification of God. And God's just going to lay low every concept of God that they have in Egypt. So behind the scenes, you have this spiritual battle going on. And on the scene, you have the government of Egypt coming on strong. They're going to be stronger than they ever were historically. So here we have a new dynasty being introduced. Okay? Okay, the next king is not overly important in that dynasty, but the one that follows him is. His name is Pharaoh Thutmose the First, sometimes called Thutmosis. Okay. His dates are circa 1535 to 1510. Okay. Pharaoh Thutmose the First. Apparently, the severe oppression begins under this man. Or at least, if it hadn't begun, it continues. We'll put begins, because that's where the text of Scripture sort of places it. In other words, during the birth of Moses, we know that there was severe oppression, and the birth of Moses comes under this man, circa 1526 BC. Okay. Thutmose the First had another important event in his life, and that was the birth of his daughter Hatshepsut. So I want to put a little diagram up here, okay? Hatshepsut is most likely the daughter of Pharaoh that finds Moses. So up here we're going to put a generation chart. Pharaoh Thutmose 1. Okay? Now, like all good ancient kings, he had more than one wife. And out of one union, we'll put her over here, and no name, out of that wife is born, first of all, Hatshepsut. Hatshepsut is the first woman liber. And the only difference between her is that she had to parade herself as a man, because in her age she couldn't get by with it. So she is such a dominating force that when she comes to power, she sees to it that all of her exploits are paraded, particularly on her temple. And I'll show you a picture of her temple next week. It's a colonnaded thing. It had a boulevard running straight down to the Nile, 3 miles long. And all along that boulevard, there were palm trees and these little granite sphinxes that were carved out. It's a magnificent temple built herself. And then on the walls of this temple were all of her exploits. And her pictures of herself on that wall, she's pictured with a beard like a man, and she's dressed like a man. Okay? Okay, Hatshepsut is a key figure in this whole plot that's going to go on in in Exodus. Okay, she dies circa 1479 B.C. Okay? Now, from another marriage, and we'll put her over here, from another union, Pharaoh has a son who is very anemic. He is Thothmes II. And he dies about 1501. He dies circa 1501. Okay. Which means he reigned about 10 years. He took over when his father died, and he reigned about 10 years. But he was so anemic that he didn't have any power. And the power behind the throne was Hatshepsut, because these two marry each other. Okay? So this line is going to indicate marriage. In other words, Hatshepsut marries her one-half brother. The reason for that was that they believed that if you could get royal blood together, you would have a concentration of royal blood, and something magnificent would be produced. In this case, nothing is produced. They are heirless. Okay? Now that can't go on in royalty. So they work out a deal where Thothmes takes a harem girl, and we'll draw her over here in this dot, and he has a child by this harem girl, and this child becomes Thothmes the third. Okay? Okay. This guy is something else. But unfortunately, when he comes to reign, he is only 10 years old. And so he is under the control of this dominating woman named Hatshepsut. See? He is dominated. He begins reign. He reigns from circa 1501 or 1500 to 1447 B.C. So he is, the oppression begins under Thothmes the first and continues under the second, but it intensifies under Thothmes the third. So here we have intensive oppression. Okay? And from the time he is, let's see, how can I say, until he's 30, he is controlled by Hatshepsut until age 30. Okay, she dies. He's about 30 years old. He is so angry at his, what would you call, stepmother? I guess so. I don't know what relation he would be. His father's wife. He is so angry at his father's wife when she dies that he takes and destroys practically everything that he can find that has any information about her on it. I'm assuming that you know that that the Egyptian pharaohs, their public relation program was always built around their tomb or their temple or some palace that they built or some obelisk that they set up in the desert. Now, if you became a pharaoh in Egypt, the first thing you did was pick out the spot you wanted for your tomb. And then they would begin to build your tomb the minute that you became the pharaoh. And then any other type of a monument that you wanted to make to yourself, you would make it and you would have it veneered in granite, and on the granite would be the exploits of what you've done during your career. Thotmes III took the veneered memorials that Hatshepsut made to herself and he tore all the veneer off. Then he re-veneered them and he claimed credit for what she had accomplished. I don't want to play this man down because he is the one who leads Egypt to power under the new dynasty. He is the one. This man is known as the Napoleon of Egypt. He still has 30 years to reign after Hatshepsut dies, and he takes full advantage of it. He makes 17 raids into Palestine and Syria. He attacks Carchemish on the Euphrates. He breaks the power of the Hittites and the Amorites in the land of Palestine so that when the nation of Israel marches in, the land has already been conquered. A pylon at Karnak gives a complete list of his conquests in Palestine, in which a score of cities, Bible-named cities, were conquered by Pharaoh Thotmes III. His tomb is in Thebes, and his mummies in Cairo. Egypt must be heaven, is his theme song, because my mummy came from there, is sort of the idea. Okay? This man, then, is important. Let's list him separate. Let's pull him out now. He becomes important. Pharaoh Thotmes III. He is the Pharaoh of the oppression. Okay. To help you with your chronology, Moses is circa 26. When he begins to when Thotmes III, you might find these kings mentioned as Thutmosis III. When Thotmes III begins to reign. Now, if Hatshepsut is the daughter of Pharaoh, or if Hatshepsut is the daughter of Pharaoh that pulled that baby out of the bulrushes in chapter 2, then Hatshepsut was like Moses' godmother. And Hatshepsut most likely is that woman. Which means, when Moses forsook Egypt, he forsook an opportunity, maybe even a potentiality, of being a pharaoh in that land. He is raised by Hatshepsut. I can't wait to show you the... I was going to do it today and I came down to get our little film strip projector and it's not working. So we're going to have to rent one next week. Okay? Got the picture? One more that we need to put down. If this chronology is correct, and we have no reason to doubt it, Pharaoh Amenhotep II. Amenhotep II, 1447 to 1421 BC, is the Pharaoh of the Exodus. And under this chronology, we are dating the Exodus 1446 BC. Huh? Now, I don't know if I've this is the age of Egypt's splendor. After Amenhotep II, there will be a decline in some of the pharaohs that you're familiar with. Akhenaten. Akhenaten, who worships the sun, and whom secular history books parade as the first monotheist. How ridiculous. He worshiped all the gods of Egypt. He just emphasized the sun god as the greatest god. Not a monotheist at all. You've heard of him. You've heard of King Tut. Tutankhamun, right? Aren't you going to San Francisco this summer? Gee, now's the time to go to San Francisco. King Tut's... all of that exhibition is going to be out there. Nefertiti statue, Nefertiti, which means the beautiful one has arrived. And she was a knockout. I don't know if all that PR was her own PR, but she was a good-looking gal. That exhibition is now being circulated in the United States. It's something worth seeing, I'll guarantee you. But these pharaohs, whom you've heard of and so on, they come in the 14th century after Amenhotep, and Egypt is in a little decline, and it isn't until around 1300 that she comes back up under a man named Ramses II, and she has a little pinnacle right there, but nothing to equal the splendor of this century right here. And it is at this time that the Karnak and Thebes and all these magnificent buildings in central Egypt are built, and they still exist today, and they're overwhelming in their splendor. The columns are as high as this building, and they're made out of solid granite. How in the world did they stand them up? It's incredible. This is an age of great splendor from human viewpoint and great power in Egypt. But all the people of God know, and all they can see, is domination and persecution and slavery. From their point of view, it was a terrible time. But behind the scenes, there is a God who is personally identified with those very people in oppression. And he is getting ready with a strong arm to pull them right out of the midst of that magnificent nation and the horrendous persecution that they were under. But they couldn't see it. All they're going to do is experience it. Just a magnificent picture, and you can spiritualize the picture of what's going to happen in the rapture. Very similar circumstances are going to occur. Okay? All right, any questions about this sort of parenthesis, which we introduce at verse 8? He is the son. And up here, I think he's the son, I'm pretty sure. I didn't extend my... he's the son, yeah. He's the son. If you wanted to know about Amenhotep I, he fits in right here. Ames, after Ames and Thotmes. This is Amenhotep I. Whenever there's a second, I always wonder about the first, so I'll just... He fits in those 10 years right in there. And he's not too important. Not too important for what we're doing. Okay? This, by the way, this is called the New Kingdom. Egypt's history outlines itself. Let's get back here to Ames. The 18th dynasty introduces the New Kingdom. Okay? This is Egypt in empire. I started to tell you that there's a little... The big mountain in this is Thotmes III, and then there's a little hill at the end called Ramses II. And then from then on, from 1150 on, Ramses II, he dies in the middle of the 12th century, but they continue in decline, and then they are invaded. And they are nothing. And they never have been anything ever since. Never have been. But here they are in empire, see. And the history of Egypt divides itself very nicely into the Old Kingdom, the Middle Kingdom, and the New Kingdom, and there's an intermediate period in between. This is the New Kingdom. It is Egypt, whatever you see of splendor. Now, if you go and you see the pyramids at Giza, they're not really much to look at because they've been stripped. See, they've been raped. They were all veneered with granite, and that granite's all been taken off the Cheops, Khufu's pyramid. You know, 451-foot one was 480 feet when it was originally built, but it's been raped. All the veneer's been taken off it, and all the stuff on the inside's been taken out. And they come from the Old Kingdom, see. And the Sphinx there. Who's the head of the Sphinx? I forget. He's from the Old Kingdom, see. And you look at those, and they're not so spectacular. But when you really want to see something spectacular, see, you go down to Karnak or down to Thebes. You see something enormously spectacular. And the thing about Tutankhamun that was so significant was that when they found his tomb, here was a tomb that had been untouched. It hadn't been sacked. And that's why all those treasures are so precious, see, that they got out of King. Apparently. Apparently they decided they could use them as slaves, and
there's no indication of how long
that law decreed, no. And that we definitely know that it came under Ptolemy's I, and he died around 1510. Okay, let's go back to the passage. Now the theme, you see, the theme of the passage is not this history. The theme is the passage that is that the increase is going to continue despite the oppression. See, so we have first of all a new dynasty arises, and we've covered a little history on that. Now let's pick up the theme from there on. Point B, verse 9. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we." Now, whether that was an honest statement or not, in other words, did the children of Israel actually outnumber the Egyptians? Most likely not. But in terms of their concentration, in terms of their homogeneity, in terms of their unity and strength, yes. So they were a threat. And they were particularly a threat in view of the fact that Israel had just came out of a time when they had been conquered by these foreigners. So all that was needed was another invasion and then a rebellion of the Hebrews, and maybe they could take over. So he's afraid of that. So his human viewpoint then now swings into action. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. Yeah, that's what he wants to stop. And it come to pass that when they are fallen out any war, they join also to our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Okay? So the next thing that you have emphasized in verse 8 and 9 are the fears of Pharaoh. Okay, now which Pharaoh was it? Most likely, Thotmes I. I'll put a question mark there because it could have been Amenhotep even, see? But most likely Thotmes I. Okay? That's verse 9 and 10. Okay. Now, what does he do about it? Point C, the action. Verse 11 through 15. The action. The action now is an effort to stop the increase. Don't let them multiply is his idea. Therefore they did set over them taskmasters. The taskmasters were simply Egyptian labor gang bosses. They began to divide the Jewish population up into labor gangs, and they assigned them a task, They separated them geographically, and they put labor gang bosses over them. Okay? So the first thing that they did was divide the people, divide the Jews, into labor gangs. Okay, with taskmasters. Dominating bosses. They're just like slavery. And we're told that they built for Pharaoh treasure cities. Now, you don't want to get the idea that that's where he stored his money. He wouldn't store his money in a place where it was, you know, sort of in an area where it would be easily invaded. And that's where these cities began, okay? They built cities. And these two cities are named, or two of them are named, I'm sorry, Pithom, and Raamses, or Ramses, okay? Now, here's where the liberals want to late date the book from. They say there was no Ramses at this time, so how could they have built the city of Ramses? The answer is very similar. This is an updated name, okay? This is an updated name for the city of Tanis or Zoan Avaris. Tanis or Zoan Avaris. Okay? Same town. These are the ancient names. Okay? The ancient name for, well, we don't know what the ancient name for Pithom was, but it's probably now Tel El Rataba. Tel El Rataba. Okay? In other words, when they built the city, they really didn't name it Ramses. This becomes a later name for the city. Do we have an illustration of that? And have we changed any cities in the United States? What was Denver when it first started? Was it Denver? No. I'm not sure. Pittsburgh. There you are. What was Pittsburgh? You don't know what Pittsburgh was when it... Fort Duquesne. What's the matter, you people? Gee whiz. Pittsburgh was Fort Duquesne. There was a fort there, right? Where the... would you like me to go into the details there? Okay. And it was known as Fort Duquesne for a long time. Then it became Pittsburgh later on. Okay? Yeah, okay. There's a good example where you change the name, the Boulder Dam to the Hoover Dam. Yeah. That's the same thing here. And the names we have recorded were the later names. In other words, they came on later in history. That's all. Very simple explanation. No reason to try to date the Exodus from then. Now, what were these cities? These were cities that held weapons. See, these were catch cities where weapons and supplies and catches were stored. See? Weaponry. Catches. Supplies. Okay? They were for protection, was the idea. Now, the idea was to use the Jews for this and suppress them and stop this this production. See? But the more they afflicted them, here's the result, the more they multiplied and grew. And the word grew there is the word parats. I think it's also a PL stem. Let's see if I put the vowel point there in the right place. I might have a vowel point there in the wrong place. But anyhow, it's the idea that they spread out. In other words, they just kept multiplying. So the result was, verse 12, result, increased production. See? Now this is, see, that you can see now, see, that's the theme of this chapter. Anything they tried to do to stop this from happening, they couldn't do it. So they resort to another tactic. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage and mortar and brick and in all the manner of service of the field. All their service wherein they made them serve was with rigor. Okay? So they increased the burden, verse 13 through 15, increased burdens. But it's still not going to stop them, see? So now we have the drastic final action, verse 16 through to. The drastic, final solution. Kill the firstborn males. Kill the males, not the firstborn. Okay? And the king of Egypt spake with the Hebrew midwives, of the name of one was Shiphrah, and the name of the other was Puah. These two women gain sort of eternal fame, so to speak. They get their names in the Word of God. He said, when you do the office of the midwife to the Hebrew woman and see them upon the stools. Now the stools were simply a pair of stones upon which a woman that was ready to deliver crouched. Okay? Just two stones. They didn't have the bed with the stirrups and all this modern stuff that they have today, of course. They just had a couple rocks that they sat on. And you see them upon the stool. If it be a son, then shall you kill him. But if it be a daughter, then shall she live. But the midwives feared God. That word feared, I wish I had time to give it to you. I don't. It means to reverence. It's the name, it's the same, it's the verb form of the noun which says in Psalms that God's name is reverend. That's why you should never call a pastor reverend. That's a name for God. So the idea is they revered, they reverenced God. It's not the normal word for fear. And they did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they saved the men's children alive. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said unto them, why have you done this thing, and you have saved the men's children alive? And the midwives said unto Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for when they are lively, and they are delivered ere the midwives come in unto them. Now, was that a lie or was that the truth? Why would they have midwives if they delivered this? Well, they'd have a midwife. It doesn't matter if it's a lie or if it's the truth. It really doesn't matter in the long run. It may be true. And the idea then would be, once they had delivered, then they would have to kill the mother. See, if the mother delivered and had that child, they're not going to get the child and kill it without killing the mother. But if they got the child before the mother knew what had happened, maybe they could kill it. But in this case, they wouldn't do it. Okay? So when Pharaoh asked them why, he said, well, they're too fast. They deliver before we even get there. You have the next verse says, therefore God dealt well with the midwives. Now, why did he do well with the midwives? Somebody says, hey, here's a moral problem in the Bible. The midwives told a lie, and then it says, God did well because they told a lie. No, that isn't what it says. First of all, it doesn't say they told a lie. That's an assumption. The reason God did well with the midwives was not because of what they said, but because they had respect for life. That's why he dealt well with them. They wouldn't abort, or they wouldn't kill an ill child. He spared their lives. Now, if they did tell a lie, let's assume that they did tell a lie. It isn't God that's going to bless a lie. That's not the idea. He would bless their motivation, but he wouldn't necessarily bless their means. He's against lying. So there's no problem in the passage that way. Came to pass because the midwives feared God that he established them houses, or he made them households. They apparently, in this case, they didn't have a household of their own, so he saw to it that they had a household in which to live. And Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. You can keep the daughters. Apparently felt he could absorb these Hebrew women, make slaves out of them and so on. Keep them, but kill the male children. We are in the time of Thutmose the First, because Moses is going to be born in the next three verses. Okay? Thus ends the chapter. I don't want to say thus ends the sovereign production. Do you catch the idea? The idea is that human instrumentality, no matter how powerful it was, could not stop the sovereign God's purpose for these people at this time. Now in chapter 2, he's really going to turn the tables on them. See, those of you who are always fearful of the devil and demons and everything, you're fearful of the wrong, you're in the wrong camp. The devil's always a loser, see? He is always 100% a loser when it comes to dealing with God. And that's what God's going to show in this book. Okay, and very subtly behind that first chapter that lays the background for the book, that's the theme and the introduction all wrapped up in one little chapter. Any questions we could try to answer? Next week we'll talk about the birth of Moses into this scene. Shall we close in prayer? Help each believer, our Father, to draw inspiration from the truth of your word, from the fact that in your timing, in your desires, when your time has come for an event that you've purposed, that all hell cannot stop it. And we thank you for this magnificent introduction to a book that illustrates your sovereignty and redemption. We pray you'll stimulate each of us to be desirous and present in the studies. We ask in Christ's name. Amen.